Our philosophy discussion group, The Moon's Lost Light, page 13, The Effects of Chava's Sin. You want to start, Marilyn?
Yes. Reminder, the following discussion describes how things were throughout most of world history. There are differences in our times, which are discussed later on. The Torah tells us of the curse of pain in pregnancy and childbirth, which came about as a result of the bodily changes that occurred after the sin. Pain in childbirth is actually a physiological wonder because it defies the biological rule that when nothing needs to be corrected, natural processes are painless. Yet God changed the normal rules of nature in order to enable the rectification of Chava's sin.
Yeah, let's stop there for a minute, because that hinges on what we just talked about.
Yeah, so does that mean that animals do not have any pain when delivering?
That's what it means. You watch an animal. Have you ever seen an animal give birth?
Yeah.
It's an exertion, but it's really like a big bowel movement, kind of. Like there's some pressure, and they have to push, but they're not crying, they're not whimpering, they're not suffering. No, they're not. You know, and they don't have pain afterwards either. I mean, they might be a little more tired, but it doesn't hurt to sit. You know, like you don't see a cat sit down and say, meow! They don't do that. They're fine. And you see, like, I'm sure you've watched, whether it's in live or on videos, like a giraffe being born.
Right,
you know,
right.
So the giraffe just basically comes out and then gets licked by the mother, and then they go and eat some leaves.
Yeah, horses too. Cows. Yeah, exactly.
Right, no, it does not hurt them if everything's going right. If you read the All Things Bright and Beautiful series, did you ever read that? Mm-mm. Such a nice series.
About he's a veterinarian.
The Yorkshire veterinarian in like the 30s or something. Such great stories. But so of course there's lots of animal pain there because he's the vet, so he's called when they're in trouble. But it's only if there's trouble.
But they still go through a gestation.
Sure, but it's not uncomfortable. They don't feel like a beached whale. You know, they're not polishing like we are. The poor elephant has a 2-year gestation, I think. But and armadillos can go up to 4. You know, they can stop their gestation if it's a time of famine. Just pause it.
Interesting. Wow.
And then continue it when there's enough food. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Which animal can do that?
An armadillo. Yeah. Huh. Yeah. So, all right. Yeah. So with human beings, that natural order was changed to give us a measure of suffering that other animals don't experience for the sake of this rectification. And, again, you might ask, that was Chava's problem. Why do I have to suffer?
Yeah, I mean, that's been going on for a long time. When is that rectification done?
Oh, it was a very big of era.
A very big of era. It takes a long time. Wow.
Right. I mean, if you think about it in a way, like, let's just try to think of something physical. A volcano, Mount St. Helens, blows, right? Ash is spewed everywhere. Let's just say there was a human project to restructure the mountain the way it was before it blew. And so you have teams of scientists and volunteers, whatever it is, searching the globe for every speck of ash and to bring it back and put it back together. Mm-hmm. How long would that take? Right?
It's a good example.
That's not a 10-year thing. It's not a one-generation thing. It's not a one-century thing until it would all be found and all put back. So spiritually, this was much bigger than a volcano. This created a transition that had ramifications that were so far-reaching that the rectification is so huge that each one of us who holds a splinter of her neshama has to participate in it. And it's a multi-generational, multi-millennial.
And multi-ethnic.
Yeah, well, because we're all... because we're all related to Chava.
Right.
Yeah, this is about females, not about Jews. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The changes were not only biological. There were social and emotional changes as well. Because Chava led Adam to sin, she was punished measure for measure with, "He shall rule over you." This was a fact which became implanted in nature. Before the sin, there were no economic needs. Everything was perfectly suited to mankind in the Garden of Eden. Clothes and shelter were unnecessary, and food grew on trees ready to eat. After the sin, all that changed. Woman became dependent on man for her survival. The Torah tells us that she became emotionally dependent on man as well, as it says, "And to your man shall your longing be." The result was, "He shall rule over you." We'll keep going.
Yeah, or do you want to say something? I mean, we see that.
Yeah.
You know, you see people who get divorced, and who suffers? It's the mom.
Yeah.
If she's single, I mean, if she doesn't have kids, so that's one thing, she can, like, make another start, maybe. But that's only in today's society. You know, if you look back 300 years ago, she suffers. Mm-hmm. A lone woman cannot be.
Yeah.
Cannot be. She is really...
No status.
Right.
At all. Yeah.
No status, but... And she's financially uncared for.
Mm-hmm.
Also, so she really is very vulnerable. Even today, though, and this I learned from Esther Wien, just to think about, like, in the bracha, Shalom Asani Isha, not such a terrible bracha, if you think about, for a man to say, if you think about how hard it is to be a woman. I mean, first of all, you do have, forget about the period stuff and the, you know, and the discomfort of mm-hmm. the actual female parts and being female in that mm-hmm. sense. But I don't take out the garbage at midnight. You know, right outside my door, usually. I'm just like a little, like, why should you walk? Like, or if, let's say, I'm up at 1 o'clock in the morning and I realize we don't have whole milk for breakfast, I will wait until it's light to go buy it. I'm not going to go to 7-Eleven or King Supers in the middle of the night with my husband asleep in the house and he doesn't know where I am. Like, I, it's not safe. But he would.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
it would be okay for him to do it.
Yeah.
But it would not be smart for me to do it. Because I'm female. And then think about divorce. The single mom with a couple of kids, she's going to suffer for decades.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and he is not, he gets off scot-free in a way he goes, even if he has to pay something. Like, it's just, it's a whole different life for him. You know, he gets invited out for Shabbos every meal, and she is home with her kids, trying to figure out how she's going to do carpool and deal with that one, and her job, and, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it really is, she's very vulnerable.
Yeah.
And when she doesn't have the protection of a man or the partnership of a man, so we do live in a partnership way, but there really is the...
Okay, so that's interesting. That's going to bear just what you said
okay.
in the sex passage. The difference between men and women in marriage also came about as a result of Chava's sin. The sages say that the fact that a woman may have only one husband, while a man may have many wives, was one of Chava's curses,
uh-huh.
probably because his issue was what prompted her to convince Adam to sin.
Right, because the snake wanted to be her husband, too.
Okay, so just like jealousy. I mean, she was really...
Who knows? And how she can split things.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe she could split allegiances then. Today she couldn't so much. I mean, who knows what...
Hmm.
Not in a healthy way. Not that it would be good for a household.
Here, too, we can see this change on a physical, social level. Before the sin, birth immediately followed conception, so there could be no doubt as to who the father was. But after the sin, there were 9 months of pregnancy. Thereafter, if a man had more than one wife, it was clear who both parents were. But were a woman to have more than one husband, one could not be sure who the father was. That's the reason why the line follows through the mother, right?
That's the reason why Jewishness follows through the mother.
Yes.
But the household follows through the father,
right.
if you would know who it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
It
is worth noting here that although polygamy was accepted in ancient societies around the world, Judaism discouraged it. Taking another wife, although technically permissible, was considered wrong unless there was a truly justified reason. We see the Jewish attitude towards polygamy in the words of the prophet Malachi. When rebuking the men of his time for taking a second wife, the prophet says, "For God has testified between you and the wife of your youth, whom you have betrayed, and she is your friend and the wife of your covenant. And guard your spirit, and do not betray the wife of your youth." The prophet also says that God will not accept sacrifices offered by priests who hurt their first wives by taking a second wife.
Mm-hmm.
When the men answered that Abraham also took a second wife, the prophet answered that this was only because the first wife was barren.
Right. So even it is allowed,
mm-hmm.
and we do see times where it's for the sake of the children, in
mm-hmm.
the case of barren, or for the sake of the woman's protection. Let's see, how does that work? I'm trying to think now, but I don't think it is. If a man dies childless and his wife is then married by a brother, I think if he's already married, he doesn't have to take her. I don't think Yibum applies if he's married, so that she would be a second wife. So I don't think it actually does apply. But I think that there are times in different societies when a second wife was taken really for the protection of the woman, like if she was an older single or
mm-hmm.
or early widowed or whatever, that she it's better to have her be part of a household.
Right.
You know, so
yeah.
that So it's not really for the... It's not because the
it's
man...
It's not lust.
Yeah, it's not because the man wants a bunch of extras, mm-hmm. just that, you know, what are you going to leave her hanging? You know, that it is about taking responsibility and bringing her under your fold.
That's not today, though.
No, we're not permitted. Ashkenazim are not permitted today.
Really?
Sephardim don't today either, but I don't think there was an official edict. But there was an edict in Ashkenazic lands, and there's a few different reasons for it. One that's frequently given is that it didn't look good, made the Jews look bad in the eyes of the Goyim. The Goyim weren't doing it. So the Goyim in Ashkenazic lands were the Christians who don't do it, whereas the Goyim in the Sephardic lands were the Muslims who do it. So the Jews didn't look bad if they did it. So Jews did do it there. So there was that one, that was one reason, but that wasn't the only reason. I think, according to Beryl Wine, a significant reason, and there may have been some others, but this one made a lot of sense to me. The Jews in the Ashkenazic lands were chased a lot and uprooted a lot. They were not in the Sephardic lands. In the Sephardic lands, they may have had some bad times,
in Spain,
but they weren't kicked out and chased like the Ashkenazic Jews were constantly. Every Monday and Thursday, they were moving to a new community.
Right.
If you had a household of multiple wives, you might send this wife with her children in that direction, and this wife with her children in that direction, or even if you didn't send them that way, that might happen in the middle of the chaos. And then, who knows who's marrying who?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like those kids grow up and they're really half brother and half sister, but that's usher in marriage.
Right.
Right? So that might have been a big reason. Right. That might have been a big reason also that in the chaos of the tumultuous lives of the Jews in Ashkenazic lands, that it was forbidden for Ashkenazic Jews to do that. And it was not forbidden for Sephardic Jews until basically the State of Israel, when they made one law for all Jews, because the Ashkenazic Jews that came in, and it was Ashkenazic Jews who ruled in Israel, too, whether it was in the rabbinate or in the government, both Ashkenazim were in charge. But as the Sephardim came in, some with multiple wives, so they were grandfathered in. But you're not allowed to do it anymore, so no taking. But if you come in as a Sephardi with multiple wives, you're allowed to keep your wives. You don't have to let go of them. But there's no more marrying multiple wives.
Cool. The sin's ramifications were not only social and physical. There were spiritual changes as well. The Zohar says that Chava's name before the sin was Chaya. The name Chaya has the letter Yud in its center. The Yud signifies the highest level of abstract wisdom. The loss of the letter Yud from the woman's nature means that woman lost her abstract wisdom. This is alluded to in the diminution of the moon, which was caused by Chava's sin. The moon's lost light represents a woman's lost spiritual perception. Let me just finish it. Both Adam and Chava lost their very high level of spiritual perception as a result of sin, but Chava, who initiated the sin and convinced Adam to go along with her, lost more perception than Adam did. So that's why, basically, women are not allowed to study the Talmud. They do not have the, they have the bina, but they don't have the dat.
Right.
Yeah.
In general, as a group.
Yeah.
Right. And that's what we'll see, I think, in this next paragraph, it looks like. But it's interesting, I mean, with the overall theme, you know, that we'll see going through the book, with the restitution, because there is the promise of the restitution of the feminine energy in the end of days, we certainly see a difference today, and we see the struggle today with how that plays out, but we definitely see a restitution today for Dot in women. So we do, and it does seem strange, and my husband likes to harp on this, but he's like, how is it in an age when you can have a nuclear physicist and a chemist and your physician and your accountant and your lawyer and your, and they can all be women, but not your rabbi? Like, does that make sense? So that bothers him. He feels like we're in a time and a place where women have different roles and different capacity to understand and bring it to bear. That one realm doesn't seem to make sense. I hear that. He says parents, child, and there is a merit to that. Well, yeah, there is some merit to that.
Yeah.
There is. So I mean, I'm not going against the halacha. I'm not advocating against going the halacha. But we are in witnessing a tension in our times of the restoration of a feminine energy, which includes dat, that allows women to be in professions that they never were in and be extremely successful in them. And it's fascinating to see, it could be that the reason why women can't be in shuls, because we see rabbis, when we see this in the liberal streams, is that they crowd the men out, as they are in college.
Yeah, you know? That's true. Yeah. No, my daughter's medical class was over 50% women.
Yes.
And 45% Asian.
Yes. Yeah, so the Asians and the Jews. and the women, right. So the women are crowding out the men. Men take longer to finish college now. They take an average, I think, of 60 months. And women take, I think they take 48 or maybe 50. So college takes longer for men. There's a higher dropout rate for men, and there's a lower enrollment rate for men altogether in college in general. And then with the professions, women are, you know, scooping it up and going forward.
Yeah, but couldn't we look at that as a portent of the coming of Mashiach, the end of days?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's a good thing.
Yes and no, as we'll see as we go through the book. That, I mean, one of the things she discusses, which I think is fascinating to consider, is that, yes, it's a portent, and certain things are supposed to happen, and how will they be fueled? From Kochot HaTumah or Kochot HaTahara. Mm. And so sometimes we can push the envelope too quickly, and then what should be the symptom of positive change is actually something that's been pushed and is fueled by Kochot HaTumah instead of Kochot HaTahara. So rather than it being the natural evolution of the unfolding of the end of days, and so if there is a shift and it comes from Tahara, mm-hmm. it can be the forcing of the issue.
Mm.
Like, for instance, and she gives this example of communism, right? There is supposed to be an equality of all people. But communism didn't achieve it, but its underlying mm-hmm. philosophy mm-hmm. was that.
That's right, yeah.
But because it was fueled from Kochot HaTumah, right, it didn't get where it was supposed to go, and in fact the opposite, and really harmed people. You know, they say that capitalism is the exploitation of man by man, and communism is exactly the opposite.
Okay. I was going to use another metaphor, not a metaphor, but the fact that the Haredi believed that the organization and the founding of the state was really not... It needed to be waited for in time. And that's one of their issues.
Right. So not... Yes, that was pushed. Definitely
a
machloket. It was definitely pushed. And the question is, what was the energy that fueled it? And I think
they
we can see
secular
both,
Zionism.
I think we can see both energies actually
yeah.
fueling it. I don't think it's so clear.
Mm-hmm.
Because we do see negative flowers blossoming from the pushing mm-hmm. of the founding of the state. And we also see positive. So I think that was probably a real mixture. There was definitely some L'shem Shemayim aspects of it.
Mm-hmm.
And there are definitely some not. And we see both commingled. It's like poison ivy and an apple tree, you know, like
yeah.
it's they're both growing together. You mm-hmm. can't detangle them.
Right.
So Hashem's going to have to do the detangling. And people can point to either one.
Yeah.
But that's why the tefillah, it's interesting, the tefillah in the modern Orthodox world, when they daven for the State of Israel, they call it Reshit Tzmichat Gulatenu, the beginning of the flowering of our redemption.
Mm.
In those few in-between shuls that are not fully modern and not fully Haredi, because the Haredi ones don't say it,
mm-hmm.
and the ones that are fully modern say it that way, but the ones that are slightly in-between who want to say it, but
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. So they say, Reshit Tzmichat Gulatenu Bezrat Hashem Yitbarach.
Mm.
That this should be with the help of Hashem.
Help
no, we're not. We don't know. We can't say this is the beginning of the flowering of our redemption. They say maybe Hashem's will that this be the beginning of the flowering of our redemption, right? So they add that in to like,
mm.
right? I heard somebody. It was funny because I had Shabbos lunch with Rabbi Avi Weiss. So we talked a little bit about the modern Orthodox community,
mm-hmm.
the Haredi community, and the secular community. So. So he was joking. He said, the, where you live is that where the Zionists are? I was like, on the
hardly.
Side. He said, so what do they do on Yom HaTzmut? Do they say Hallel with a bracha or without a bracha? They don't say Hallel, right? It's a question in a place like Edo, so you for sure say Hallel, mm-hmm. but the question is, do you say it with a bracha or without a bracha, right? So he was joking. Do we in Zer Abraham say it with a bracha or without a bracha? So we don't. Right, so he said, what about Tachanun then? Do they say Tachanun? Because Tachanun you don't say
yeah.
on a holiday. Okay, so you don't say Hallel. That's proactive. But do they recognize at least enough of a festive nature that they wouldn't say Tachanun on that day? So he said that there are secular Jews who would say, I do what Ben-Gurion did. He wasn't observant. He didn't say Hallel or Tachanun.
<Number one.
laughs> So,
oh,
anyway.
That's good.
Yeah.
Consequently, we find the many descriptions of women as lacking intellectual understanding and unsuited to Torah study. Although there always existed exceptional women, the situation was the norm. Not only in the physical and economic arena, but in the spiritual one as well, man would now be the leader. This is because the sin changed the nature of most women from that of an abstract type to that of a concrete type. Concrete types are not intellectuals, nor are they interested in metaphysical contemplation. They understand things on a more external level. Concrete types have capabilities and interests in concrete, physically related activities such as cooking, sewing, carpentry, gardening, organizing the physical world. Abstract types, although they may also do well in concrete activities, possess an added dimension of understanding of and interest in abstract ideas. They understand underlying principles behind ideas. They understand the underlying pain. Are often interested in philosophy, the metaphysical, and the hidden workings of the human psyche. Unlike concrete types who are interested only in the practical application of knowledge, the abstract types want knowledge for its own sake. Abstract types are both capable of and really need intellectual and quote-unquote soul activities, as reflected in deep Torah study, and sometimes intense and even mystical levels of prayer. Today we find both types among men and women, but this will be discussed later.
It's interesting. Here's just one sentence that she probably didn't think about, but that the abstract types may do well in concrete activities, but they have an added dimension,
mm-hmm.
or they could have an instead of dimension. There's plenty of abstract types, the absent-minded professor,
mm-hmm.
who's not good at all in concrete activities.
Right, right.
You know,
idiot savant.
Yeah,
yeah.
There often is one or the other for either one, and then sometimes they can be blended,
mm-hmm.
or sometimes they're stronger in one than they are in the other. But there's definitely the abstract types who don't function well in the concrete world at all.
But I guess these are sort of the general concepts, you know, is what he's
right. I'm just
to,
saying, here's a yeah. that's an example. I mean, just that's important to know too. That it's not
yeah.
it's not just that it's an added dimension. It might be an instead of dimension for some people.
It is important to understand that it was not only Torah law that caused women to be excluded from Torah study, but the changes in nature and in woman herself. Were a person to lose 80% of his vision and as a result be denied a driver's license, we would not call this unfair discrimination, but rather necessary law. It is not the law which causes the suffering or inconvenience, but rather the person's own limitations. The Torah's laws deal with these situations in the best way possible. So it's recognizing from the get-go that women have limitations.
Yeah, but don't...
And therefore cannot...
Yeah, let's see what this paragraph, I think...
And so although Jewish law makes man the leader, Jewish men are told to treat their wives better than themselves and not to pain them, even emotionally. A Jewish wife had many rights and was to be viewed with respect. The sages exhorted men to honor their wives, for it is they who bring blessing to the home. Although, as we said, men were generally the leaders, when a woman was truly qualified, men were expected to follow her advice. I mean, the judges, the women judges.
Or Sarah, a wife that's smart.
Similarly, a capable woman who studies Torah is rewarded for this. Yet women were not taught Torah because they themselves were usually not suited to it. Okay, so they were told they weren't suited.
Or they weren't. I think it's hard for us to know.
Yeah.
But let's just try to think back 300 years. Is it because women were oppressed for thousands of years that women were not capable, did not read as much, didn't think as much? Why don't we hear from women authors? We have a narrative today in women's studies or in left-leaning colleges and things that it is because of oppression that women weren't permitted, and therefore we don't hear female composers or female authors or female anything. But I'm not sure that's right, because if the women then were like the women today, this smart, this driven, right, this capable and powerful, I don't think we would have stayed down for thousands of years. It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
You know, like how, like take us back, just put us all in a time machine and send us back 300 years. We're not taking no guff from a bunch of guys, and it's not just sociological. So it seems to me, like I think what she's going to try to say here is that we are actually different
mm-hmm.
than our great-great-great-great-great-grandmothers. We do think differently than them. Not just because of the society, not just because there's been equal opportunities, or whatever opportunities, different opportunities, but because we're actually different. So some of that's driven those additional opportunities. Now that women can, they are, and they push, and they're changing. And so there's maybe a reciprocal action between the drive and the change, and the so that there's a nature-nurture interplay here, mm-hmm. where both nature is shifting because of the restoration of the moon's lost light on a spiritual level, and the nurture is shifting because of the way women interact with society. So things are shifting on both parts, and so women really are different today.
Life was so different then, too. I mean,
yeah, that's the nurture part.
Yeah.
Yes, it was so different.
Women weren't out there. They were totally in the home.
Yeah, really.
Men weren't out there either.
Yeah.
Only some were. There were some. I mean, but just not that you can really learn from it, because it's definitely caricatured. But let's just think about Tevye and Golda, right, in Fiddler on the Roof. So he wasn't out there either.
Yeah, he was a schlepper.
He was schlepping milk cans mm-hmm. and hollishing for the ability to spend an hour in the base medrash, not hollishing for the ability to speak from the podium, just to be able to learn an extra hour.
Yeah.
That he shouldn't have to work so hard, that he would have an hour to sit and learn, right? That was his dream. I just want to be able to read,
mm-hmm.
right? So he wasn't out there, and most of the Jews through many of the ages were Tevyes.
Mm-hmm, right.
They were schleppers, right? Although the minute we got an extra speck of money, which meant an extra speck of time, we had Torah study guilds. I mean, there were Mishnaic societies for wagon drivers. They would take time off and go learn together. Or for all different things, in the last few hundred years, different things. So we do believe in universal education. And we do believe that education empowers. And we do want people, not empowers like in America, like we have public schools, so education empowers, that's how you make money. We do believe in apprenticing you to a trade so you'll make money, but not necessarily that way. But education spiritually empowers. The more you learn, the more connected with Hashem you get. The more connected you get, the more you can daven better. The more you can daven better, the more you can learn. The more you transform yourself through your brain. So we do value brains and what they can bring us to. And for the bulk of history, most Jews, male and female, didn't really have access to that.
Yeah. I'm just thinking of the series of books. It's somewhat, it's a lot of fiction, but Rashi's daughters mm-hmm. were highly educated.
Yeah, they learned Torah.
And they learned Torah and Talmud, and but their father was Rashi, so.
Right. You know. Okay, so that, first of all, that is fiction, and that is written through the prism of today.
But it's not fiction, it's true, though. He did educate his daughters,
yes.
right?
Okay. So I do want to say that, yeah. So that's why I particularly like the book, The Memoirs of Gluckel of Hamelin.
I read that one, too. Yeah, that was the first one.
Because it's written by her in 1690. Yeah. It's not somebody's imaginings in the 21st century of what life was like then. That's what life was then. Mm-hmm. She writes about it. That's her actual diary. So we do see through her how educated she was. So there were women who were very educated. Was she out there? So she ran her home, and when her husband died, she took over his business. And his business was gems. And so she did have to make negotiations and meet with different men and drop those contracts, and she did it.
Mm-hmm.
Was it about being out? So it wasn't. In a way, she was a liberated woman in that she had a partnership with her husband. The partnership was, you earn, I'll spend. You bring it home, I'll make it into food. I'll make it into clothes for us. That's our partnership. Mm-hmm. Oh, you're not there? Okay, I have to take over both halves of the job. Right? I got to earn it, and I got to spend it. So, but that is a partnership, mm-hmm. if you see it as a partnership. Mm-hmm. It's not a diminution of the female that you have to stay in the house. You're only barefoot and pregnant. That's how you're good. That's not what, there is a partnership there. So, and yet the woman definitely feels the need to be part of that partnership. She is alone without it, where he's not so alone without it.
Yeah.
Right? So,
well, the woman in Nation's Heil, isn't she?
She does all kinds of stuff.
She does all kinds of things.
Yeah, she does. Right. She does, yeah. She's out there. She's mm-hmm. doing business and all kinds of things. Absolutely. Running her household. And yeah, so we definitely see the creative ability of the woman brought to bear on her home and on Jewish life through Eshet Chayil. Yeah, so that's a great example. So that's over 3,000 years ago. This is an ideal woman, what she does. She's busy with a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
Is she sitting and learning? It doesn't say that in Nation Chayil.
No.
No, it doesn't.
She's more consumed with the materialistic and mercantile activities, really.
Well, running her household, feeding her servants, mm-hmm. bringing home some money, and spending the money. Mm-hmm. When I say spending the money, I don't mean going to the mall. I mean translating money into food and chairs and clothes. Somebody has to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't live on money. You have to translate it. So she's the translator. So she is the one who takes the potential, which is what money is, and makes it into manifest, usable stuff. Right, so that is the female role in general, to take the potential. Just in thinking about, I'm sure you've read Rabbi Tatz, right? So he gives the seed and she holds it for 9 months and brings the potential into fruition. That's her job, is translate potential into actuality. So that's why it is her job to spend the money, not necessarily to earn the money. It's his job to bring home potential. It's her job to make it into food. So it's not that she wasn't creative. So that's what I'm saying. You look at something like that, and then you look over our last 3,000 years and say, where were the female sages? Where were the female artists? Where were the female? They weren't doing it. I think there were some. There was the same as there was Devorah the judge, who was a total aberration. Mm-hmm. There were not a lot of women like that. That's not a role model of a Jewish woman. She's one Jewish woman who did something weird. That's not what they did. Right? So the same thing with George Eliot. Didn't have a lot of female authors at the time. So she made a masculine name so people would read her stuff, right? It was an aberration. Oh, it changed. Now we have tons of female authors. But at that time, there's only a few. Not because there were... And there was repression, certainly. But they weren't all... there wasn't... It's not like they were repressing a groundswell. Maybe there would have been more with less repression. But now... We have broken through that because you could say, do the Carol King and I'm Woman, Hear Me Roar, right? But it's not just about the roaring. It's we have more roar now. We just have a different nature about us. We're different. So I think that's what this is saying. I don't think it's all about repression, although if you look at the Muslim world.
If you look at the big picture, though, this could all be just, leading up to all the this whole explosion of women's rights in the last 50, 60 years, for good or ill, is all part of this final.
That's what she's saying.
Yeah,
that's what she's saying. Basically, that is the theory here that she's exploring. Because why didn't this happen 300 years ago? If women were just like us, this smart and this driven and this savvy, why weren't they composing classical music? You know, why weren't they writing books? Why weren't they doing research? Why weren't they writing poetry? At least liturgical poetry. Why don't we have that? Because they weren't writing it. They just weren't. That's not what women were doing. They had a different way of thinking about the world than we do today.
Right. After Adam and Chava ate of the tree of knowledge, the entire world became a mixture of good and evil. The woman's job was now to repair the damage by removing the evil from the good, by keeping the negative, don't, commandments. It was also a woman's job to put the harmony back into creation by using the physical world to attain a spiritual purpose. Okay, that's her job. This, too, is reflected in the change of woman's nature from Chaya, which has a yud in its center, to Chava, which has a vav at its center. The letter vav, unlike the letter yud, comes quote, down to earth, end quote. Vav means a hook, which connects things, and it also means the letter, quote, unquote, and, which connects two ideas. This reflects woman's new role, to come down to earth and deal with the material world, but for the purpose of connecting heaven and earth. Man, too, had these tasks, but in addition, he was to rectify creation by taking from the tree of life through studying the Torah. This is man's greatest task. The essential nature of man and woman usually reflected these two tasks. Woman was involved primarily in the concrete areas, and man, although also involved in concrete activities such as farming, had his most important role in the abstract activity of Torah study. There were exceptions among both men and women, but throughout most of world history, the system generally functioned well, because each side was dealing with the area to which they were naturally drawn. Okay.
Right. Okay. Esther, you want to keep reading?
Okay. Less important in whose eyes? Did these changes cause women to become less important? That depends on how one defines importance. They did not cause woman to have less value in God's eyes, but because one's value is not determined by one's gifts or one's status, but rather by how well one uses his or her abilities. The principle of equality before Hashem is demonstrated in the following midrashim. U'devora isha nevia. And Devorah was a prophetess woman. What is the special nature of Devorah, who prophesied over Israel and judged them, even though Pinchas ben Elazar was still alive and functioning? That is, there was a worthy man in the generation. Why appoint a woman? I bear heaven and earth to witness, whether a man or woman, whether Jew or Gentile, whether manservant or maidservant, all according to the deed does the Holy Spirit rest on him. Indeed, the sages tell us that just as there were 600,000 prophets in Israel, so there were 600,000 prophetesses too. And in another midrash we read, Shemaya Tefillah, he hears prayer. Rabbi Yehuda ben Shalom said in the name of Rabbi Elazar, the nature of flesh and blood is that if a poor person comes to him to tell him something, he does not listen. If a rich person comes to say something, he immediately listens and accepts it. But the Holy One, blessed is he, is not like that. Rather, all are equal before him, women, slaves, poor people, and rich people. The same language is used regarding Moshe, master of all the prophets, as is used regarding a poor person, to inform you that all are equal in prayer before God. The sages also say that it was in the merit of righteous women that our forefathers were redeemed from Egypt, and the future redemption will also be in the merit of righteous women. The well which sustained the entire Jewish nation for 40 years in the desert was in the merit of Miriam the prophetess, and it was Hannah, the mother of Samuel the prophet, or Shmuel the prophet, who gave us our present form of silent prayer. The holidays of Purim and Hanukkah came about because of Jewish women who were ready to give their lives for the salvation of the Jewish people. These are only a few examples of the high level of the righteous Jewish woman. In fact, a righteous wife is considered so important, as the sages say, that when a man marries a kosher, that is, good woman, it is as if he had kept the entire Torah from Aleph to Tav.
Okay, wait, so Esther was Purim. Who was the woman in Hanukkah?
Yehudit and a bunch of different women.
Okay. Yehudit was the mother of the Maccabees?
Or the sister.
Oh, the sister.
The sister of the Maccabees. There's a few different stories of women. So whether these are, you know, apocryphal or not, mm-hmm. they still show the energy of what was going on with the females at the time.
Right.
So one is about during the Hanukkah time when the Greeks were there. So the Greeks had a law that the governor gets first crack at the Jewish bride.
Right.
So when it was Yehudit's turn to get married, the Maccabee sister, the guys weren't doing anything about this. So finally, the Maccabee sister goes in public before her wedding and disrobes in public. And they say, what are you doing? That's such a breach of tznius. And they're like, she says to them, oh, you're worried about my tznius in public? And you're not worried about who's going to sleep with me after my wedding? What is going on with you? Wake up and go fight the war, because we're all getting raped. And you think undressing in public is a problem. I don't think so. So that's one.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then another is stories of women who, one of the laws was to not brisk the sons. Mm. And so also they weren't fighting. The men weren't fighting properly. So the women pushed them towards that fight. So there's a story, whether it's true or not, but just shows the power of the women, that they would brisk their sons and then jump from the top of the walls of Yerushalayim to commit suicide with their babies. To create a stink that they say we can't brisk, we're brisking and we're going, because this is a must, right? So there's that. And then also Hanukkah is the story of Hannah and her seven sons, where they all murdered themselves. They were called by not by Ahasuerus, but by somebody, a governor, I think, who went to, I think it was in Modin, were told to bow down to the idol, and they didn't. So one son after another was killed, and first, in front of her,
mm-hmm.
they're all killed. Finally, they get to the youngest son. You know, he's four or whatever. So how much could he know? The governor really, in a way, he doesn't want to kill the four-year-olds. Mm-hmm. He wants to let them off the hook. So all he says, instead of he's saying, bow down to the idol, he takes the ring off his finger and throws it in front of the idol and says, go get my ring for me. So they'll have to bend over in front. Mm-hmm. And he says, no. Mm. So he's also killed and she's killed. So Hannah and her seven sons, but she's seen as the strength behind those children, that she gave them the proper kind of chinuch, which is part of Chanukah, is chinuch. Yeah. She gave the proper chinuch that those sons were able to withstand that test and realize that there are transcendent values. Mm-hmm. And life is extremely important, but only in as far as it sanctifies the name of God. And maybe you have to sometimes give up your life for the greater value of the sanctification of God's name, because that's the whole purpose of being alive. Don't stay alive and not sanctify God's name. So all those women in Hanukkah.
Cool.
Okay. Want to continue?
Oh, we're going to stop.
And yet.
Mm-hmm. And yet with all this, women were not fully equal in human eyes. The Ma'or, the Shamash, a Hasidic commentary based on the teachings of the Arizal, explains that since the diminution of the moon, there cannot be two kings with one crown, and therefore even if two tzaddikim are equal in their characters, one will be more recognized and honored in the eyes of people than the other. This principle is illustrated in the following story. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Elam, a great tzaddik and Torah scholar, was told in a dream that his place in the world to come would be together with someone named Nanas the Butcher. Astonished, he set out to locate this man. After much searching, he found Nanas, a simple Jew who, in caring for his elderly and infirm parents, showed tremendous devotion in the mitzvah of honoring one's parents. Upon discovering this, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Elam declared, "Fortunate am I that my share in the world to come is together with Nanas the Butcher." A person's place in the world to come is his true spiritual essence, based on his accomplishments in this world, and in this, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Elam and Nanas the Butcher were equal. But in the eyes of the world, there is no doubt that Rabbi Yehoshua ben Elam occupied a much higher position. For this reason, we find that the birth of a son was greeted with greater joy than the birth of a daughter. It was usually only sons who could be expected to provide material support. Although a good wife and mother is a blessing to her husband and children, the daughter was usually not able to give much in return in terms of honor or wealth to the parents who put so much into raising her. For Jews, there was an additional reason for preferring a son. Only through a son could one fulfill the command that you shall teach them the words of Torah to your sons. Since women are not commanded in Torah study, and most women were not suited for it, the woman's share in Torah is usually acquired by helping others, her husband and sons, to study Torah. Therefore, parents who wish to fulfill this mitzvah preferred a son who could study Torah to a daughter who could not. This, however, represents only the human view. The rabbis taught, greater is the promise that the Holy One, blessed is He, made to women than to men. This is because the reward for enabling another person to do a mitzvah is greater than the reward for doing the mitzvah oneself. One reason for this is that the silent partner's efforts are not truly appreciated in this world. Specifically, because supporting a mitzvah is less prestigious than doing it oneself, it shows more selfless devotion, and therefore the reward for it is greater. But human beings do not see things that way. From the human point of view, not the desire of son who could study Torah would show a disinterest in Torah study. People who respect Torah would rather be the parents of Rabbi Yehoshua ben Elam than the parents of Nanas the Butcher, even though in Hashem's eyes, both are equal. Similarly, parents who love Torah study prefer a son who could do so to a daughter who could not, even though in Hashem's eyes, to selflessly support Torah is considered an even greater accomplishment.
Very interesting. Right, and women are, of course, as you know, the behind the scenes. You know, somebody's hiring a secretary for an institution in town, and they tried to make a job description, which really could be summed up as his work wife. He needs a work wife. You know, somebody to keep him in line, somebody to order everything, keep the books, make it happen, keep the place clean, you know, take care of the errands. Like, It's a work wife, you know, mm-hmm. just run everything and do everything so that he can be free to be the man on the scene. You know, but what credit does she get for that? Except for he could never do what he does without that. So, yeah, but doing all that does.
But, you know, that it's a pretty sophisticated argument today, particularly among women that are not necessarily learned or have studied. I mean, I'm using myself as an example, that when I first started out learning, I was very incensed that women had, in my view, a lesser role in Judaism. But now, studying and learning, I do understand the meanings behind right. a lot of this, and I realize that, you know, woman's role is really, really very important.
It is. You can't it's understand essential. That without learning
exactly.
more. Exactly. Part of it, and a way that I could explain it faster, which I'll just tell you because I'm sure you have friends that don't have that kind of learning if you want to try to explain it.
Yeah.
Basically, what I do is say the woman's role in Judaism is this big, right? Stretching my arms out as far as I can for the recording, right? But in America, and Judaism is this big.
Mm-hmm.
But in America, most Jews have narrowed Judaism down to a one-day-a-week synagogue experience.
Mm.
So that all that's left of Judaism altogether, because they're not keeping kosher, and they're not keeping Shabbos, and they're not dressing in a certain, they're not speaking in a certain way, they're not even giving necessarily according to Jewish law. They might be giving more tzedakah, but really Judaism is synagogue participation and experience, because it's become very Christian in that. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a one-day-a-week experience. Inside the synagogue, there's a very little role for women. So if that's your Judaism,
mm-hmm.
where do you have a place?
Yeah.
You don't. And so you might try to extrapolate from that in this, there's no place of respect for women. But that's just because you don't know this is.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
So if you start to expand Judaism back out, then you realize, actually, women run the world. You know, mm-hmm. we're in charge of kashrut, and we're in charge of Shabbat, and we're in charge of tznut, and we're in charge of teaching spirituality to the children. Emunah is transferred through the aim. That's the root of imah, is emunah, is teaching the craft. It's also the root of the word omanut, craft, or mm-hmm. art. It is the craft. The mother is a transference for the craft of trusting God and bringing that into your life, making it manifest. And really, if you think about it, in a way, you could switch the whole picture and say, men have their little place they get to go to for their prayers and their learning, while women run the whole Jewish show. We really run everything, mm-hmm. right, except shul. So men have their little zone, and we run the show. So it could look totally flipped.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my husband jokes also, because he's that type, ironic. But he's like, it's so not fair. Judaism is so discriminatory. It so discriminates against men. Men are only allowed to hear male singers and male speakers, whereas women get to hear all of
both,
them.
Right.
It's right. so not fair. Men are discriminated against. So it really depends. It does depend on your perspective.
Mm-hmm.
The more you learn, the more you see. Women do have a very strong, proactive, and powerful role. They're not. It's not a diminishment. There is here. You'll see. That's why this is not a beginner's book. But if once you can see past, once you can see more deeply in, you mm-hmm. see a very strong and powerful role for women. But it is not leaning.
Yeah.
You know, that's not the woman's role. So you might think, if I can't lean, I'm going to have a place in shul. You know, Judaism doesn't respect me. Let's see, should we end here? Maybe
yeah,
because it's another section.
Yeah,
I think that's a smart idea.
Yeah, that's
end
great.
Here
I love
and
this
continue
book.
Next
this is
week.
So fabulous.